Ladies and gentlemen, podcasting since 2005, you're listening to Gamertag Radio with your host, podcaster Hall of Famer Danny Pena, the always opinionated Paris Lilly, and from outside of the norm, Peter Toledo. This is Gamertag Radio.
All right, welcome to Gamertag Radio, brand new episode here. And by the way, I'm here visiting Washington, D.C. for a couple of days. And I had to contact one of my friends that lives around the area, close to the area.
Hey, I'm Reed Albers. I was the senior manager of New Media and Digital for the Entertainment Software Association. You probably better know me most as the @E3 Twitter account. I've been that for 6.5 years. It started with about 100,000 followers, grew to 2.4, 2.2 million people. It's a massive account, and I apologize for invading your timelines every summer, but it was one of the most things I ever got to do.
Yeah, and actually, what was the famous tweet? Was it last year?
It was last year. We had been scheduling lots of tweets. When we started the account, I didn't want to do too many scheduled tweets. I wanted to be more live reporting about the show. And it was only me. It was just me doing it alone.
Yeah.
Fast forward 6 years later, I had Melanie Asherman, who's just fantastic, who's been my co-pilot on the account for 2 years. We had put together more scheduled tweets because we thought there's so much going on. There's so many different things at E3. We kind of got to get this more scheduled out. And so we'd been doing that. We had scheduled a tweet announcing it was kind of a generic tweet that was like, hey, happy first day of E3. We hope you loved all the announcements. What was your favorite announcement? Well, that tweet went out 7 days before day one of E3, and it went out at like 10 o'clock at night. Yeah. So I'm just driving down the road in Virginia, and a buddy of mine, Woot, sends me a text. He goes, hey, man, I love your E3 tweet. And I'm just like, what are you talking about? Like, yeah. I didn't do anything like funny or crazy today. And I go and look, and I realize the tweet's gone out. And it's gaining traction. Like Kotaku wrote an article about, hey, look, E3 is open 7 days early, according to Twitter. And, you know, those articles, they're silly and stupid and just kind of for clicks and haha. But, you know, I recognize that this is fun. And if you've grown up gaming, you know, when you make a mistake in a video game, you can either press reset or you can try to like salvage the situation and win. Yeah. And I saw the opportunity because if you hadn't remembered, Rage got outed. Rage 2 got outed by Walmart.
A month earlier. I remember that.
And so the first thing I thought was, man, this is another E3 leak. And I was like, we're going to just play it straight off like this was leaked. And we did. And what I loved about that was the fans responded tremendously. They loved it. They thought it was hilarious. Some even thought we were like doing a stunt. That's when I knew we'd kind of salvaged it perfectly. We had people like, oh, this is fake. You guys did that just to do a stunt and try to, you know, get people on the show. But at the end of the day, that mistake got some of the best engagement of any of our messaging. And then the response to our mistake, calling out our own mistake, got even more engagement. And we trended 7 days. Our day E3 trended 7 days before day one. Damn. And that was without a single game being announced. And so that was kind of one of my favorite little mishaps at E3. We didn't have too many of them, but you know, when it happened, we made the most out of it. Yeah. We turned it into something new.
So. That was so much fun. And I was like, man, I know it was Reed that probably scheduled it, probably put it like the wrong date. But look, it was it was a situation that turned out to be good in my opinion because everybody was engaging. And I remember seeing a lot of memes of like Back to the Future, Doc Emmett Brown.
Well, the people who I think really get the credit for taking it even farther was Xbox, Ubisoft, Activision. They jumped on the bandwagon and they retweeted it. They quote tweeted it and they were like, oh man, we're so happy you guys saw what we had today. We can't see. And they played along with it because I think they understood like it's a mistake. E3 is a stressful time for everybody.
Yeah.
This happens. It's a good time to laugh and have some fun. Also, it's just, you know, nothing was broken. There was nothing that came out that said like, you know, we didn't reveal like Anthem was coming out or something like that. It was fairly harmless. And so to see the companies kind of jump in and enjoy it and have the moment, I think it was like Bandai Namco that had the best one. They were like, oh, I can't believe we announced it. And it was like blank. And we announced blank. And then we announced blank.
That's funny.
And fans have fun. And, you know, walking around the show at E3 that year, people would bring it up and they're like, I loved it. That was funny. You know, that's what you guys are known for, is these kind of funny, manic, chaotic tweets and for just kind of, you know, making a big scene. And you guys did it. And so I was really happy with it. Melanie was shaking her head. We had a lot of fun with it. You know, we wore it around our neck with a lot of pride that week at E3.
Yeah. And honestly, it got me excited about the event too. So that was cool. That was cool. I know you don't work there anymore, right? You don't work at ESA anymore.
I left in November at ESA. They're great people. You know, I had a great time working there, but decided to move on to some other opportunities. Been doing the dad thing. Love doing that. But yeah, I mean, spent 6.5 years at the ESA.
Yeah, and that was your first video game industry job?
Yeah, I had started out as a journalist. I was a sports journalist. I started out blogging about the Capitals on my own blog while I was in college at VCU. And then I got into local preps and local college writing with some local newspapers. And then I transferred that into writing about the Capitals for the Washington Post commuter paper, The Express. And so I kind of built this media career out of blogging, and I saw an opportunity with the ESA. They wanted a new media associate. They wanted just like, you know, your bottom rung of the marketing world, just an associate to come do social media. And I thought, well, I can do that. You know, I was already promoting my writing for my journalism and for my blog all by myself.
Yeah.
So it was really something that I thought I could do really well. I was able to get the job, and I liked taking the reins of the social media for the Video Game Industry Association. Mm-hmm. And it really turned into something bigger than I thought it would, partly because of E3. That E3 account wasn't being utilized in a way that, you know, Twitter should be utilized, and quickly turned that around, and then quickly used that excitement from E3 and the audience we were building there to highlight what was going on at ESA and what was going on with things we worked with. And, you know, social media has really changed the way we get our news. I always say people used to wake up and go get their newspaper in the morning. Today, people wake up and roll over and grab their phone and look at Twitter.
Yeah.
You know, that's the first thing they look at. So having a strong social media presence, and one that was, you know, had an audience and that people could rely on and say, oh, there's actually someone behind this, was pretty important. And it's something that I got a lot of freedom to do and enjoyed doing it for the ESA.
Yeah, and I think you and there's probably other people in part of your team at that time, that a lot of us content creators, we were trying to register, get media badges for E3. And I feel like the ESA was kind of confused about the whole YouTuber thing, podcasting at the time too, and everything. And I think you and your team were the ones like, no, we got to change things here based on feedback. Because the issue that I had with ESA back then was they'll go to our website and check our numbers. I think, I can't remember the name of the website. It was like a website that checked like the rankings.
Right.
So, but I'm like, look, there's people that don't visit our website, but I could show you our download numbers because people just download our content. So the numbers are off. You know, you can't base it on just that. And I think also with the whole YouTube, the Twitch streams, it changed throughout the years. And I think now the process is a lot easier now compared to back then.
You were like the first person from the podcasting and content creator community to really kind of vocally say like, hey, look, this is not working. And I knew that from being a blogger. One of kind of the stories about being a blogger was I started as a journalist in college. I just wanted to do it to write every single day. I wrote about the Capitals, favorite hockey team, something that was easy for me to write about. And over time, the Capitals, they had noticed they were not getting the coverage they wanted in the Washington Post, but there was this army of bloggers out there who liked the team and were willing to write, you know, positive, fair, and critical articles on the team, but it was better coverage and they were getting more views from that than they were begging the Washington Post to come write an article about their struggling hockey team.
And they're local.
Yeah, and they're local. They are the local hockey team, and they could not break over the noise of the Redskins or the Wizards or anyone else. Yeah. So that the Capitals PR people, Nate Ewell was his name. He was a big digital guy. He started inviting bloggers to the press box, and he credentialed me as a blogger. He gave me a full season credential with The Express. He gave me credentials with my blog, Capitals Kremlin. And I was sitting next to writers from Canada who were, you know, legitimate journalists, if you want to call it, and doing my thing with them. And that made me realize that that's the future of media. The future of media is not in just the Washington Post brings a reporter. There are people out there who can go out and make news for you, and they will do it in their voice, and they have very specific audiences, and they know how to talk to them better than anybody else in the world can. And the first thing I thought about when I was working on the E3 account was, that's E3. Yeah. That's, I mean, like, that's Gamertag Radio. That's Greg Miller. That's any of those people. You're not working for IGN. So it was difficult for you because we didn't see the letters IGN and we didn't go, well, that webpage gets hundreds of thousands of hits every day, so you're valuable. But then mm-hmm. when I was explaining to them is, look, it's not about the webpages. It's about the fact that they've got a social media account with 20,000 people. They've got 10,000 downloads, or they've had 20,000 downloads on this episode alone. They're getting guests from our industry. You know, you guys were pulling guests who are actually game developers who are working on major publisher games, mm-hmm. and yet you're having trouble getting into the show. That was difficult. So something we'd done was talk about, look, let's not go with the web hits. Let's go with things like downloads. Let's go with social media influence. Often or not, I would just say, look, just approve this person because I know they've got a big audience and I've got it. One great example is Britt Bromsher. She was working at Berlin Nerd. She'd gotten credentials before. She told me how difficult it was. So I just helped that move that along, not because it was like some personal favor, but because I knew, well, she's got a big audience and she's been developing this audience. And if she gets to go to E3, people will come listen to her and then her audience will be bigger. Yeah. And then the next time she comes to E3, people will know she's going to E3 and they'll listen to her even more because now she's someone who does this and goes to E3 and has the respect of being able to go to the show. And so I wanted that to go out to more people and more bloggers, more social media influencers, more podcasters. As Twitch got big, that became a big thing as people from Twitch wanted to come. So now it's a lot easier to get a badge as a content creator. And it's something that I hope ESA continues to innovate because those are the people who are making the news in the industry. You know, GameSpot, IGN, they all make news. They all cover it. They do their thing. But the influencers and the content creators, they can go out and they can make content for very specific communities and it can just blow up. Mm-hmm. So that was really something I really enjoyed working on that and being able to, like, you know, get you guys into the show. And,
yeah.
You know, I never got to ask is like, was it harder from, you know, from that day forward? Was it easier? It felt like my Twitter inbox went from all sorts of podcasters being like, please, can you help me? I can't, mm-hmm. I need to prove to them. I need to get in. I've got all these downloads to, I never heard from them. I just saw them because they were at the show. It wasn't a problem anymore.
Yeah, no, now it's a lot easier. Like we applied and a couple of days later, we just got approved. I'm like, all right. And I'm like, look, I could show, I have the numbers. Mm-hmm. We've been attending E3 for so many years. What is it that we need to do to prove to you guys, like, hey, look, we've been there. Make it easier for us. Don't make it difficult every single year.
Yeah, and that modernization just helps so much, modernizing what media is at E3. Yeah.
And I think, too, is, you know, a lot of the people that probably start working at ESA, they probably don't know mm-hmm. how it is. And that's part of it, too. And it's just more educating people how it is. You know?
I think there's a misconception that people think ESA is, like, for gamers or for developers or for this. Well, there's a lot of lawyers. It's a lot of lawyers. It's a lot of policy analysts. It's a lot of people who understand government, state and federal government.
Yeah.
They represent the game publishers. And so when they're putting on an event like E3, yes, there is some knowledge of video games. Myself included, Melanie, Richard Dilio, who works there. You know, we all love games. The communications team like loves games. They get it. There's some, you know, we can't go out and talk to gamers all the time because you're representing publishers. But when it comes to E3, we understood. We understood what needed to be done to really maximize it. And so that's kind of, you know, something I think that when people look at ESA, they go, well, you know, ESA is being silly. They're not letting podcasters in. Well, it's, you know, they don't have a lot of people who understand that media. And so then they did, and that helped a bunch. And now it's just kind of commonplace. So that modernization of what is media at E3 went a long way. And I think it continues to go a long way in the future of the show. And I think that it's dried the type of media that comes and the type of new media that gets invited as media evolves will be tied directly to the success of the show too.
Yeah. And I know you're not working there anymore. So as a fan of just games, mm-hmm. What are your thoughts about, you know, Sony saying, hey, we're not going to E3 this year, maybe in the future. Mm-hmm. To me, you know, they're one of the big publishers, companies that are always there at E3 to promote like their products and games and so on. So I was very surprised that they said they're not going to be there this year. Maybe the year after, maybe they're going to be there, you know. But what are your thoughts about that, like, as a gamer?
I wasn't too surprised. And the reason why was because at last E3, there was kind of a moment that I noticed. People talked about it. Was that during their press conference, they had people, like, going to these experiences to see games. And they said they had four of them. and they lined up the journalists to like walk in and stand. You guys had the stand in like parking lots. Nobody liked that.
I was there.
And yeah, so you remember it. And they said there was four experiences. They only moved you to two rooms. I don't remember the other two rooms getting used. And so what I had noticed was that Sony didn't have a ton to show, but they didn't want to overpromise. I think in the past they've done things like say, hey, look, we're doing Shenmue 3 and it's going to be crowdfunded. And we're doing The Last Guardian, but we don't have a release date. We're actually just announcing it again without a release date like we did years ago. And that is something that I think can be difficult for some of the publishers, is when they don't have a lot to show off, or maybe it's a year where they're feeling like their lineup is not as strong. It can be murderous to go into E3 with nothing and then put on a show that's subpar or not as good as the guy next to you. E3 is so competitive. And so I look at Sony's comments. You know, one, they said they want the show to evolve and they feel it hasn't evolved enough. Well, you know, that's their opinion on it and they have their thoughts on it too. They think the show has changed from being a business show to being more of a consumer showcase, and it should follow more in the steps of Comic-Con. There's a lot of truth in that. I mean, you look at that Twitter account alone, kind of shows you the attention people have just for the idea of E3 and the brand of E3. So people expect big things. And if you don't always have big things, it can make E3 kind of difficult for you. But also, there's a lot of business that would get done at E3. And Sean Layden made an interesting comment. He said, you know, we used to have the show, and in June, we would sell all sorts of product and deals and sponsorships at E3, because that's when people from like Walmart would come. That's when the people from Best Buy come. All these buyers come. They're ordering pallets of video games for the upcoming Christmas season in June while the show is going on. That's what the goal is of the show, is to help sell and create those business partnerships and get it out there and help create the next big video game. Yeah. Now that stuff's happening earlier. Now that stuff's happening just on its own. Walmart doesn't need to come to E3 just to see a Sony game. They can just call Sony, or Sony can put on their own event and Sony can just do whatever they want. They'll have complete control. They can invite whoever they want. They won't have to worry about what media is coming, because they'll be the ones choosing the media. They can choose the time. They can choose how they show it off, how much they show off, and how much of it is playable. I think another thing that Sony probably was worried about, and we've seen it from other publishers, is you come to E3 with this build, an E3 build that you've toiled and labored on. And if it doesn't do well, your game is starting at like a negative. You're starting behind because you had a bad E3. And you might actually have a really great game, but now you've got the consumer opinion is this game wasn't ready. This game didn't look good. It was running on PC and it was supposed to run on Xbox hardware. And we caught a picture of that. There's a lot of stakes, and it can really hurt your future of your game. And so I think Sony is really more or less, I don't think it's so much of them abandoning the show and saying, you know, E3 is not relevant, E3 is not useful. I think it's more or less of them saying, you know, we've got new consoles potentially coming. We're at the end of a cycle. At the end of a cycle, you're generally announcing things like sequels. You're not really showing off new IPs. You're really trying to gear people to stick around and spend money on your console and get ready to go to the next one. I also think they probably don't want to just reveal their system just at E3, because then they have to compete with anyone else revealing their system at E3. They could just own it themselves by doing it in March or doing it in April. And they did that with the different PS4. Time.
Yeah.
Then they came to E3 with it. So I'm very curious to see what Sony has in mind instead. And I'm curious to see how well it does. Doing your own event is not new. EA does it with EA Play.
I was going to mention about that.
Yeah. Well, you know, EA Play is a thing. It does well. It tries to kind of, it's at E3, but it's not at E3. I don't know if Sony wants to do that or that's what they're trying to do. But, you know, people have done the satellite E3 thing. And what I always point out is that it still revolves around E3. You might as well just be under the umbrella if you can be and take advantage of it. But I'm curious to see what people want to go forward with and what they kind of see as the future. If they want a show that's more for business and more for selling, then I'm interested to see what is the sort of thing they put on. And then also, how much does not having a press conference or having a presence at E3 as a console maker? You know, EA is not a console maker. They can, you know, I always said EA is still at E3 because EA games are at the Xbox booth or the PlayStation booth. You can still go play EA games all over the floor because they have so many deals with third-party publishing. They don't need to worry about, well, we're not at E3. They're not at E3, but their games are still at E3. It happens. Sony, your first party, that's a little different.
That's a bigger
gamble. So curious to see what they do. I think that, you know, the show probably will evolve and continue to evolve and change. I think that the criticism or thoughts from Sony will be taken, you know, they won't be taken lightly. The show wants to be around. It wants to be the best game show. I want it to be the best game show. I think it's a great show. I'm just curious to see, does Sony create something that sets a new trend and everybody starts doing that? Or does Sony kind of maybe eat the loss and say, you know what, we're just going to lose E3 for a year, so to speak. And then we'll be back with what we actually want to show you, because we don't want to show you a subpar lineup and end up being the laughing joke of E3. We want to be the winners of E3.
Yeah.
And you can't do that if you bring a bad show.
You know what? Honestly, taking a break is not bad. I think it's a good thing. So more power to them. Now, what year was it that you started working for the ESA?
2012.
2012. So let's go back to 2012.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was still strictly media, right? Still up there, right?
Yeah.
I was still... Maybe a couple influencers, not like how it is now.
Mm-hmm.
So when was, from behind the scenes, as a person that doesn't know anything about the ESA or anything like that, behind the scenes, when was it that the team was like, okay, we need to change E3. We need to get the consumers more to get involved. Let's get more influencers because things are changing. And I think if you don't change and you don't evolve, I think it will hurt.
Mm-hmm.
It will hurt E3. So when was the timeline, do you think, that made them decide, okay, let's try to change for this time?
Well, you know, I don't know if it was so much a timeline as it was that we had these conversations every year. I think a lot of people, I'd walk around the floor and people would be like, God, you really need to have a business day. And, you know, you say, oh, thanks for the feedback and be nice about it. Well, we thought of that. We've thought of that for years. You know, there's contracts in place. There's union labor that's in place. There's schedules that need to be met. And there's also other shows moving into the convention center. So evolving the show actually takes a lot more than just sitting down and saying, okay, we're going to let consumers in. There's a lot of considerations that have to happen, like public safety, fire codes. Where are the people going to go? You know, how are you going to entertain 15,000 more fans?
Plus the city of LA, strict.
Exactly. And it's the city of LA.
Yeah.
And also, you know, 15,000 more fans. Well, boy, is this a consumer show now or is it a business show? You know, how do you manage that?
But see, that's the problem, because I know you guys trying to change that, right? Mm-hmm. But maybe publishers didn't really want that. Maybe they wanted to still keep it the same way so they could promote their products not only to the retailers, but also to the media, investors, right? Now you get the consumers involved to attend the event, and now it will create this chaos. Like, how can somebody that have a meeting with, can they attend our meeting room and make it easier for them to be there on time, but then they're all over the place. There's people. It's packed.
And E3 is expanding. It's spilled out of the convention center to all around LA Live and all around LA. So it's just, it's a bigger event now. I think that's exactly what Sony was kind of saying, is we want to do business and you've got a ton of fans here and we don't have a ton of stuff for fans. But getting kind of back to the question was that ESA every year thinks about, how do we improve the show? How do we change the show? What do we need to do? Anything from, let's add business days. Well, can we do that? Well, no, we've got contracts. We can't do that. Or let's add consumer early hours, or let's do, you know, there's all those thoughts come in. I'd say, you know, I came in at 2012 and it was still a business only show, but there was already that discussion going on about, should we add the consumer? Should we not? And so it kind of evolved to, let's add prosumers. And that's kind of a bad name, because that's just influencers, in my opinion. That's media. I mean, you might as well just call them media, because a prosumer is somebody who probably has a large following and talks about your game all the time. And so they're just kind of like a little Trojan horse media for you. And then there's, you know, people like, you spend a lot of money on DLC and stuff and they get invited. And so they consider, well, those are consumers. That's all the consumers we need. And then it started to kind of evolve a little more into, well, maybe we need to open the doors to the fans. And I'd say that happened about 2 or 3 years after I joined ESA. But it really, I think one of the mistakes was that we tried to dip our toes in. We did a thing like E3 Live, which was like this weird outdoor activation that didn't have a whole lot going for it.
I remember that.
And like those decisions get made because it's a group decision between ESA and people who make up the ESA, the members, because we would make a plan and say, this is what we want to do for E3. This is what we think we can do for you guys. And they'd say, yes, no. So they're buying into it too. They may not you know, they may have ideas that they want that they're not going to get because it wasn't like a consensus of the group, but they're hearing these ideas. So when people ask, you know, I think the number one thing people asked this last year with the consumers back for a second year and, you know, with security heightened was, why can't you do business days? And the answer is quite simple. There's another trade show coming in right after us. We have to be out of there. It takes, you know, it takes days to set up that trade show. It takes days to tear it down.
And that's more money for the companies too, right?
Well, think about this. If you think Sony's having a hard time saying, justifying the cost of E3 because they don't think it's a great business show, tell them they need to do two more days of it.
Yeah.
And that's something that every publisher is going to take a really deep breath and go, that's, you know, more time getting our people out there. That's more time away from development. That's more time doing, you know, that's more time having to do demos. That's more time having to hire people to be at E3. It's a stressful show anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a lot to ask for more days. So that's why it kind of fell at, let's do tickets and limited number. It's about 10,000, 15,000, I believe. Don't want to go on that one because I'm not sure, it changes each year.
Yeah, yeah.
But they extended the hours. They made the show longer, which I think actually kind of worked out pretty well. And the show probably could have been longer to begin with anyway. But people have thought for a long time about like, well, why can't you just add the consumers? Well, there's just so much that goes into it. Even the idea of adding consumers, it's not the idea of you're adding fans. It's the idea of you're adding 15,000 people who all need to be entertained and need to stay somewhere and need something to do and also need to be able to walk your show floor and get around easily, but also not feel like, you know, they didn't get their money's worth or something like
that.
So there's a lot of consideration that goes into making those decisions. And so the fans, I'd say articles have been written for decades about if fans should be in E3. It's a conversation that happens every year, and it's a conversation that happens every year after the show is, should we do the fans again?
Yeah. And I think you were learned like from the experience, hey, was it a flop? Okay, let's change it next time or let's change it the next day or something, you know? So in a situation like that, planning to get more consumers and influencers to attend E3, you guys would talk to the publishers in advance, because that's how it works, business and all. And now, were they like the idea? Because I think, in my opinion, I think that's the main reason why EA left E3, because they just want to do their own thing, have the consumers to attend their own event, and at the same time, I think it's them in a way for them to control the message.
It is,
you know. So
it is.
So
it's full control.
Yeah. So the companies were like, you know, I like this. This is good. Let's test it out. Let's see. Or they were like, nah, I'd rather just keep it business. I don't want this.
I'd say, and you saw from the Sony reaction and from Xbox, Sony says we're not doing the show. Microsoft says we're going to make the biggest show we've ever had. Some people see E3 as the day to make announcements and the event to make announcements, and others maybe not so much. And so there's an ebb and flow in the membership about whether or not, you know, they want this from the show or they should be doing this. Some companies, you know, want consumers, some of them don't. Some companies want more business hours, or they want only business hours, but, you know, you have to say, well, we can't get that for you because of these contracts and such like that. Yeah. Some kind of want to do things like, we don't want to be on the show floor. We just want to do a live stream. And, you know, other time we'll say, well, you know, we'll figure it out. And so it's like trying to please 35 masters and then every single company in games that wants to come and showcase at your show. Everyone's got different needs. And so it can be a balancing act. And I think that, you know, the E3 team, they do a good job every year of putting on the best possible show they can with what they're given and what they're allowed to work with. And I think that it's sort of, you know, when you see an EA decide to go off their own way, there's a lot more going on with that with them. You know, they've got a lot of decisions, but I think one of the biggest things for them is they, by not having to be with E3, they can now pick a day to have their press conference whenever they want. They don't have to like lock themselves in. They can just kind of do.
Yeah, there's rules, right? There's rules for like the ESA members.
I wouldn't say there's so much rules, but it's like there's a schedule, and it's a schedule of like, hey, look, you guys can have your press conference. You're gonna have this one. Let's do that, and you know, it's so that way the show moves along, and you know, you don't want people fighting, and you don't want like Xbox and Sony trying to host press conferences at competing times.
Yeah,
that would be horrible for everybody involved. So, you know, that stuff exists. But, you know, as companies came in, Bethesda joined the ESA. One of the things Bethesda wanted was they said, look, we are big enough to do our own press conference now. And so they got Sunday night and, you know, kind of changed the dynamic of the show because now you have companies saying, well, wait, now we want to go Sunday afternoon because we want to be first because we don't want to have to wait until after Bethesda.
We want to, we want to have the buzz for a couple of days before, before the show starts.
You know, and that would go on with anything. I mean, that's just the nature of competition. Is you want to be first or, you know, do you want to be first? Do you want to be last? Sony always closed out E3. I always thought that was a great move. Why? Let everyone show all their stuff and then throw the knockout punch when they can't respond.
Yeah. You know, I remember back then I used to just show up on the Sunday morning, late Saturday night, just be ready, you know, for the, but now I have to be here, be in LA earlier now because maybe Saturday might be events now, Sunday. So things have been changing throughout the years. Like everybody's like doing events pre E3.
Oh, yeah. And it's like the week is expanding. It's expanding not in terms of time at the convention center, but times that you're going to be in Los Angeles. Yeah. I used to fly out and land on Sunday. And my Sunday before the show was like, let me get ready for Monday. That's day zero, as we always called it. And then suddenly day zero became Sunday. And then suddenly day zero became Saturday.
Yeah.
And then suddenly I was flying out on Friday and landing Saturday and like just prepping nonstop for pressers and events that were going on Sunday and late Saturday. Because that the appetite to get your message out and to get on the start of the E3 wave is tremendous.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think that that's kind of one of the challenges is the show has not evolved out backwards as in like it starts Monday and it just goes longer, longer. It's evolved, you know, it's evolved backwards into the previous week now.
Yeah.
So
that's
a challenge that I think is kind of there for the show and in the future and for the publishers too, to what do you do? You know, do you go earlier now?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
you're listening to Gamertag Radio.
All right, JTR listeners, podcasts are a great source of information and entertainment. And if you are like me, you can't always remember where you heard something, right? This happens to me every time, especially during E3 time. We post like 50 episodes. I don't remember every single conversation I had with the developers or with the crew when we record our roundtable discussions. But I want to show something to you that's really, really cool. Recently, we've been using Nodecast by XIQ, which is available on both iOS and Android. Nodecast is a game changer. You could subscribe to your favorite podcast like GTR or listen to other ones too. But you can also use it to save portion of the podcast whenever you want and even automatically generates a transcript for you. And it's super, super easy. All you do is tap the Node button on the play screen or pause the podcast and say, save that. The Nodecast app will save the last 30 seconds of what you heard and you can go back and listen later. It also stores a transcript as a digital note. There's also an option, which is pretty cool, that you could have it email it to you. Again, I've been testing this out. I've been having a lot of conversations with Pete or Paris during daily conversation, right? And there's stuff that I want, like, all right, I want to remember this because Paris said this or Pete said that, and I've done that, save it to my phone, everything is good. So I could go back and listen to it whenever I want. Whether it's a great conversation, story, joke, tip, or recipe, Nodecast will help you retain information like never before. And to me, is a must-have podcast app. GTR listeners, right now, you could download Nodecast for iOS or Android by going to nodecast.app. And we've got a special offer for you, the listeners. Try it for free. 60 days, no credit card required. Just enter our code GTR when completing your sign up. Again, that's nodecast.app and use our code GTR to try it free for 60 days.
Send us your feedback or questions. Give us a call at 786-273-7GTR. Email us at fanmail@gamertagradio.com or leave a message on speakpipe.com/gamertagradio.
Now, for Reed does not work there anymore. He's just, you know, telling us behind the scenes stories. Now, every year, Mm-hmm. Every year you're going to hear people say like, well, this might be the last one, might be the last E3 every year. Mm-hmm. I've been hearing this since 2005.
Oh, yeah.
Since 2005. So you, a person that started 2012, and at the same time, you know, that's your job. That's a 9-to-5 job. You hear this like, oh, man, is it true? This is my job. I don't want to lose it.
Yeah.
So when you hear stories like that, people, even the consumers will be like, well, I think this is the last one. How's the reaction from behind the scenes from everybody there from the ESA?
You know, like, I've been hearing that for a long time. I grew up reading about E3 in EGM and getting it in the mail. And that was how you read about E3.
Yeah,
and,
same
you
know, here.
I had my opinions same about E3 then. And then it was like forums in the 2000s when I was in college and stuff. Yeah. And I saw those articles about, is E3 really relevant? Do we need or really need it? Then it's 2012 and you're still seeing those articles. It's 2019 and you're going to see those articles. I guarantee those articles are going to start popping up around late March and April. They always do. It's an easy article to write. I never really bought into it though. And the reason why is because there's so much discussion about E3 year round. How can a show that is being discussed in August of this year that the show just happened not be relevant enough for people to consider it a relevant show? I mean, Sony is making their decisions on E3 in November. They're not doing it right before. They're clearly having long conversations and thinking about it. Now, in terms of like the relevancy of the show to the gaming landscape, you just don't see game announcements like this at PAX. You just don't see game announcements like this at a lot of shows. You'll see it at Gamescom, but even then, Gamescom is almost like a retread of E3 and then some. You know, it's a consumer.
Or what if it's like having their own event?
Yeah, exactly.
So like, you know, Xbox, they'll probably have like an event in May mm-hmm. before E3. Just their own, and that's it. They don't have to attend E3 for right. them to make that announcement. Like they'll show their new console or whatever.
Right.
There could be more of that because I think the conversation started coming even more when EA left.
Yes. Absolutely.
Now see from the outside you see, oh my God, Sony too. Like what's gonna happen mm-hmm. E3? Are we going to see this more in the future? More companies leave like that. That's why the conversation is coming up a lot more now, you know?
Yeah. And I think that, and it's fair for the conversation to come up because when EA left, it wasn't just EA left. I mean, if you know your convention center, when you walk into the hall that EA is in, they are the first thing you see and they are the loudest.
The loudest.
They are the absolute loudest. Need for Speed will be blasting in your face the entire day.
Madden.
And that was something that it's almost like, that was almost your like, happy E3, here's EA blasting music in you. And so when it's not there, you notice it.
Yeah.
But that said, I looked at, you know, the conversation, how much E3 is talked about on social media, how many articles are written about E3, how many videos are produced about E3, and the number gets higher and higher each year. And I'd always say is, you know, there are questions about E3's role. Like, what role does E3 play? What is the goal of an E3 for a company? But the relevancy, it still is relevance because if you bring a product to it, you're going to have a relevant conversation about your product. And I had always said, we have a Twitter account with 2 million people. It started with 100,000. Find me a trade show that has a Twitter account with 2 million people. It's rare. You know, we had more Twitter followers than some of the companies that were announcing stuff at our show. They loved it when we'd retweet them and stuff. We could really kind of spur and prod on the conversation through that. But also, it just showed the commanding power that at any time, 2 million people want to know what's going on with E3, even though we only really tweeted that much during June and then occasionally had fun throughout the year. Mm-hmm. So I think relevancy, it's really what the conversation is, what is the role of E3? The relevancy is there. If you buy the space and you bring a game, you obviously believe in the relevancy of it because you can get big results from it. There's so much media and there's so much that's being made and there's only going to be more and more and more of it because people consume so much media about E3. Mm-hmm. But the question, like you said, is what's going to be the role? Is this where I announce a console or is this where I bring my console to show it off to play? Is this where we, you know, I always thought like Anthem. Let's take Anthem for example.
Yeah.
Anthem was something EA showed at the end of EA Play. It was a big thing and then they had it playable. What if it wasn't playable? What if they just said, this is not the show for us to bring to, this is not the game to bring to E3 because we don't think it's ready. We don't want to do too much and we want to take some more time. I think there's going to be a lot of thought about that now, which is like, is this the best place to show off this particular game? or do we go with what's safe or what's, you know, what we know?
Well, so, they also had it at the Microsoft press conference too. That's right. And that was technically part of E3, right?
Right, so, exactly. And so there it is. You know, EA kind of double dipping with, they're not at E3, but their games are partnered with their third party. So they're going to be at E3 anyway. Yeah. So, but yeah, I think that really it's the role of what role does E3 play going forward, and how do publishers adjust to that role, or how do they dictate what the role is? Because if they stop bringing consoles to debut at the show, E3 is no longer to show the debut your console at, but it still has the power to bring a tremendous amount of people to Los Angeles to come and talk about and write about and record about what you're doing. So, you know, would you not want to do that then still? Mm-hmm. So
now another conversation always comes up again, as a person that just attends E3 every year. Is it time to move on to a different location, man? You think LA to me is getting crowded, man. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, LeBron James is in town now, right? I remember there was multiple years that LA Lakers was in the finals. I think there was actually 1 year the hockey team was also in the finals. So it was that, the Lakers, them.
Yeah, the Kings.
The Kings. Who else? I think there was also a concert a couple of days after that. And there was also E3 all at the same time. Traffic was insane.
I mean, Los Angeles is the entertainment capital of the world, you know, so you've got so much going on there. You know, to tell you, there's been discussions about should the show move? Should it come east? Should it go to a place like Chicago or New Orleans or something like that? There's been lots of talk about it, but there's a lot of contracts that get put in place. The city of Los Angeles makes a lot of money off of the fact that E3 comes. That's a lot of people coming in and spending money at stores and restaurants. There's a big financial boon. So there's a little bit of, like, you know, politics in the back room going on between cities saying, well, hold on, we don't want you to take E3 away. We love E3. E3 brings, you know, 80,000 people to our city who spend money. So that's a big part of it is, you know, you've got cities who want it. They're going to, you know, if a city wanted E3, they could certainly try to put a bid and say, hey, here's what we're going to give you. And, you know, the ESA would take the best deal they could get. If New Orleans said, hey, look, we'll give you the convention center for free for 5 days and XYZ. Now, you know, that's, I don't know if that's ever been proposed, but they'll offer up perks about, you know, why you should bring the show to your city, because they know how valuable it is. And that kind of goes to the relevancy is the cities themselves know this show is relevant because it makes us money.
Yeah.
So now for me, I think that moving the site might change the energy a little bit. I think that E3, you know, it's been at LA for so long. It feels kind of old hat that it's always been at E3, been at LA. There's a good reason for that. A lot of the industry works in California. It's easy for the companies from Asia to get over to.
It's cheaper.
Yeah. You know, there's a major airports, LAX, you know, East Coast guys like us, it's easy for us to get out there. You know, it's a good location. I think what is really challenging it is just the development of LA Live and what you kind of explained, which is just LA Live, the Staples Center, and that whole area around it is just growing and growing. There was a time where they were going to build a football field there.
Oh,
and,
yeah. So it was Farmers Field,
yeah.
Right?
They were going to build a football field, and that was a big problem. There's lots of articles you can go and read about them where ESA is talking about, you know, the development of what was going to be the Rams football stadium was going to be in downtown Los Angeles. There was a big push to have a football stadium in DTLA. Now, that would have affected E3 because there would be construction. There'd be so much construction going on and rerouting, and some things might have to close and some businesses might get bought out. You know, there's so many things that would have gone on with that. So there was lots of discussion about why the show should not, like, leave while a football stadium is being built, or what is the benefit of us staying in Los Angeles while a football stadium is being built, or how are you going to develop this area in the future? LA Live is something that's really cool. Lots of people like to go and get dinner there. I saw Shaq has a restaurant there now.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the sort of thing that is that people take in consideration when choosing the site is, what is there around to do? Like, are you guys investing in us? Are you investing in your facilities to make LA a better place to have this convention? So there's a lot more than just, a lot of people think it's just like, oh, you should go to Vegas because Vegas would be fun. Well, Vegas would be fun, but what could Vegas give the show? And what could the show really get out of Vegas? And then also, does Vegas really offer what the show really needs?
I mean, it works for CES.
It does. And, you know, so CES is a much bigger show. I mean, I think that's something that people kind of forget is that E3 is a big show. It's a tremendous show. It's a big show in media. It makes lots of media. It makes a huge discussion, but it's not actually the biggest trade show in the United States. CES is still one of the largest trade shows. And that convention center for Vegas, it is cavernous and it is huge. And it would not be advantageous for a show like E3 to be in a bigger space where it's like, well, we can't sell all this floor space, but we're in Vegas because you guys like Vegas, you know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I think back in the days, this is before I started attending, E3 used to be in Atlanta.
There was one in Atlanta in 98.
Yeah.
And then that one, people don't really talk about too much.
I heard that was pretty bad.
It was just, you know, I mean, I wasn't there, and that's one of those ones. I was like a kid about E3 then.
Me too. I was still a kid.
You know, I can't remember a game that was announced in E3 98 because it's just been so long. But, you know, people didn't talk about that sort of stuff back then in like the magazines. You didn't see like, you know, an article written by journalists saying like, we need to move out of LA. And so like, we were more focused on the games. Now there's so much media being made. It's like, these are discussions that are happening at the show. And it's almost kind of foreign to think about like, wow, they're really discussing, you know, whether or not we should be expanding days. Do they not know we have contracts or things like that?
Was there other locations? That was it. That's it right there. Atlanta back then.
So they did Atlanta in 98 and then during the recession, I think it was 2009, they did Santa Monica.
I was
which
there.
Was a very famous. It's a famous E3 because it was the E3 that was like dressed down and was just not E3.
I was there. It was a very interesting experience because I'm making appointments with a bunch of companies. Like at the convention, you have an idea, okay, who's going to be where? You know, I know where Microsoft's going to be, Nintendo, right? But with this one, they were in different hotels.
Yes.
I had no idea if they were close or they were far. And I'll find out once I after the appointment, like, okay, we're located here. Mm-hmm. It was very challenging. I was late to all my appointments, of them.
Well, you know, and that's what I wonder if that's what like Sony wants, is because that was a show that did not cost as much money to make from what I understand. You know, I remember Microsoft had a big presentation for us.
Yeah.
For instance, they had like the Halo band play there.
I was staying the hotel across from where they had the presentation, the press conference. And I were hearing when they were practicing, I hear their music and everything. I was like, oh man, yo, they're going big. It's going to be all Halo.
Yeah. Well, they still brought that. But you know, I remember after those shows, being a kid, wanting to know everything about E3. And they were just like, well, that was the presentation and that's it. Like maybe a couple of interviews, maybe some stuff under NDA, maybe some piloted demos of some games. And it just wasn't as big of a show. And that prompted ESA to bring back the big loud E3, the Braum, the big trailers and everything like that. And so that's kind of, and the show is progressively every year kind of slowly worked its way back to that big, super loud show that it was. And I think 2005 was like one of the biggest. Everyone was spending tons of money
and that
on
was
their
my
E3
first,
booth.
That was my first one.
Yeah.
That
and so like one. you had this excess of spending on E3 because it was, you know, who wins E3 each year? It's a serious thing. You got to win E3.
Yeah.
And so I think that was the one in Santa Monica was to pair it back. It makes me wonder whether or not that's something that may come back in the future one day. Is like, okay, we don't need the big E3. Let's go back to the business E3, or let's go back to just, you know, 50,000 business only people just in the convention center, something like that.
Now, I know, and we're going to wrap it up soon, but I think it's cool to hear more behind the scenes stories. So I'm going to mention a couple of things and you tell me a story about it. So the year that Kanye West went to E3, because I'll tell you my story.
Yeah.
I had an appointment with Microsoft. I was supposed to check out one of the games. I think it was a Halo game. Can't quite remember which one it was. I was ready to go in. Microsoft told me, the PR, they were like, no, we got to stop because Kanye West is coming. He don't want no media.
Yeah, he doesn't want any cameras.
No cameras around where he's going to be at. And yeah, they canceled my appointment. But I remember seeing Kanye West going to the booth. Mm-hmm. And I see Aaron Greenberg, shout out to him. I see Jeff Keighley.
Yeah, yeah.
And a couple of people from the ESA showing him around. And they went to the room and they show him the game. So tell me the story. How was it like getting Kanye into E3? And how was it chaotic? Was it super last minute? Like, or was this planned?
Celebrities is kind of an interesting thing with E3 because they'll reach out in a variety of ways. I've had like Los Angeles Lakers reach out to me on Twitter through DMs like, yo, how can I get into E3? And I'm like, let me get you a badge. Hold on, you know? And, You know, but others like, you know, Kanye, he wants security, he wants safety, he wants no media around. So kind of the story behind that was I wasn't really too involved with like bringing Kanye in. It just kind of happened. And what was really funny about it was that got us one of our best media gets for E3 that year. So Kanye had that meme that he never smiles. And so Rich Taylor, who was the fantastic SVP at ESA and just a big part of a lot of success with E3, he knew Kanye was going to be coming. They had everything arranged. And he took a picture with him. And like the two of them are like doing a hug. And he's like big and smiling. And I was like, oh my God, Kanye West came to the show. You know, we've had like Bieber. We've had like tons of big celebrities before. But I just thought like, wow, this is kind of an interesting one. So I got the photo from Rich and I tweeted it out. And I was just like, okay, cool. It's a celebrity tweet. You know, people will be excited about it. The next day, it showed up in Cosmopolitan. Like, Cosmo does not cover video games.
At all.
Cosmo is making bad lists for the front of their magazine to try to get women to buy their magazine. They're not covering it. But they're in, you know, Cosmo's websites and social. There's Kanye West at E3, and there's the letters E3 and Cosmo. And it just blew my mind that we actually had gotten that get. So, you know, Kanye... You know, from what I understand, he was great. He was a nice guy and everything like that. But for me, the biggest moment was seeing that picture and posting it. And then the next day waking up and I'm like, oh my God, we showed up. We got in Cosmo.
TMZ and all these other places.
I think a couple
too.
Other, like, you know, tabloids had mentioned it. But, you know, I mean, like, celebrities at E3 is a common thing. Steven Spielberg comes all the time. I remember walking like past the Ubisoft booth and he was like playing a Rabbids VR game.
Yeah.
And I was just like, is that. Yeah, that's Steven Spielberg.
Yeah, I have a couple of stories about Steven Spielberg. One year, I think it was 2000 and was it 05? Yeah, it was 05 that Peter Moore was there. He was showing the Xbox 360 to Steven Spielberg, and he just passed by us, and they were showing him Condemned.
Yeah.
So that was the one year. I can't remember what year it was. I think it was the year that they showed, Microsoft showed Halo the Master Chief Collection. Mm-hmm. We were there. We had an appointment to see the game. And Aisha Tyler was also joining us to check out the game. Steven Spielberg comes out from the room, and they started just chit-chatting right next to us for like a good 10 minutes. And they start talking about, because she asked them, oh, so how's the Halo show? Cause they, remember the Halo TV series? Yeah, they announced this years ago. Yo, they were having a conversation for like a good 10 minutes, man. And I'm there looking at Paris like, I can't believe this is happening. They just talking about the show right next to it. And Steven Spielberg was like, oh, yeah, you know, we're working on it. We're having some issues, you know, here and there, you know, but it's gonna come out good. It's going to come out good. That was years ago. And that was at the booth, the Microsoft booth. Yeah.
Yeah. It's so I love hearing people's celebrity encounter stories at E3 because they all revolve around games eventually.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it fun is that you have these great stories about celebrities. They may not talk about games much in their celebrity life or their social accounts, but then there they are enjoying the heck out of some video games at E3. One of my favorite stories was Jack Black came to E3 last year, and my buddy Rad, who works at ESA and worked with me on the comms team, he got to show him around. And Jack Black's kids did not want to stop playing Spider-Man. Like, they had other appointments to get to.
Yeah.
And, like, Jack Black's like, come on, you got to go. We got to go do this. Like, Microsoft, they're like, no, we just want to play Spider-Man. Like, you just seeing them get so wrapped up in the show like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, I think, you know, that's kind of one of the coolest things about E3 is just seeing everybody get wrapped up in it, even the celebrities and their kids. Like, you know, Jack Black's having to pull a dad move on his kids because he won't stop playing Spider-Man.
Yeah. All right. Here's a non-E3 one.
Sure.
Trump.
Yeah. That was interesting.
So for those that don't know, explain what happened and then we'll go from there.
Well, so there was a school shooting at Marjorie Douglas High School in Florida. I think I might've had the name wrong. It was down in Florida in Lakeland, and it was just a tremendous, sad situation. I think 18 people were killed. Anytime a school shooting happens, you know, we'd be on high alert because we know what follows with that, which is video games going to get blamed, especially when it's like a high school or any sort of school environment. So we were already pretty stunned at the news that was going on in Florida and, you know, preparing like, okay, we need to keep our eye out, or, you know, does the shooter play games? You know, did he have any history of like violence or anything like that? Like what do we know about this? So we might have to prepare for it. And I'd always kind of felt like I have a feeling we might get dragged into this because I was there in 2012 after the Newtown shooting, and we got called into the principal's office again with the government with Joe Biden. And he had had some words for like, hey, you guys, you know, there's a great article you can read about it. He like yelled at us and was like, you know, somebody do something, you know, why? And because the game industry was like, well, it's not our fault. And he was upset about it and ended up working out. But I just kind of always from that moment, I just felt like, you know, people are always going to play games for violence. And so you got to be, you know, you got to be on heightened alert when this thing happens and we got to be ready for it.
Yeah.
What we weren't ready for was that Sarah Huckabee Sanders was going to just mention us out of nowhere. From what had happened was, I think it was 2 or 3 days after the school shooting, there was a question in the White House press scrum to her about, you know, what are you guys doing about gun violence in America? And she had said, well, we're doing this, this, and then we're meeting with top video game executives to discuss ways to curb gun violence. No contact had been made by the Trump administration to anybody, to us or to anyone about that. It was like something that just was said. And then we, you know, we're sitting in our office. We have TVs on all the time with the news. And we're like, wow, we just got mentioned in the, you know, our industry just got mentioned. What is going on here? So there was a scramble to kind of figure out like, who did they talk to? Did they talk to anyone? Well, they hadn't talked to anybody. And in fact, from what we'd heard, it was kind of like she just slipped the tongue that they had discussed maybe doing this. And it was like a slip of the tongue that someone else in the administration had said, well, let's have a meeting with the game industry. And so she got flummoxed by the question about gun violence. You know, the journalists were not going to let this one go. And so she pulled out games because, you know, why not? It's something everyone else does. Over the next week, it was like a big debate of do we go? Do we not? Do we do this? Is this actually going to happen? At points, it seemed like this was just going to fade away and it wasn't going to be a thing. And then suddenly it became something that got in the news. And so Trump's attention got on it. So he said, I'm going to have a meeting. And it came down to, you know, there was a meeting with Trump. And it was pretty famous that, you know, ESA had to go and meet with Trump. And what it came down to was they had gotten a coalition of people who have been very anti-video games and games violence, you know, in the past, and that was going to be the people he was going to talk to. So we got involved and we brought people to the table, like Robert Altman from, you know, Bethesda. I believe Strauss Zelnick from Take-Two went. And so they went in and we'd brought this graph that went out in 2012. There was this study about games and violence and about who plays the most games and who has the most gun violence. And you can probably figure out what that chart looks like. USA has the same games usage as all the other nations, but we have the gun problem. You know, Japan doesn't have the gun problem. Germany doesn't have the gun problem. Britain doesn't have the gun problem. Everyone's got this gun. Everyone's got games being played, but they don't have the violence issue. So our graphic designer, Melanie, who just, you know, she knew Trump is Trump. She just put a big red dot that said USA on the graph. And like, that was the graph we brought in.
Yeah.
And what I'd been told was, you know, the meeting started with Trump showing that reel of violent video games. And if you're a gamer, they picked some games that, you know, gamers would know. Like they had somebody on staff who knew their violent games. They had good taste in violent video games.
Didn't that video was posted on the White House YouTube channel?
So that we'll get to that, but yes, it did. there's a reason that's a little frustrating too.
Yeah.
So they brought this video in and it was like a who's who of violent games. And there was some recent stuff and even trailers, you know, there was games that people sitting in that room, those are their games that the president's showing them a video. And he just looks at the video and he goes, pretty violent stuff, huh guys? And the conversation kind of exchanges. And we had said, look, here's the graph. He saw the graph. Marco Rubio was in the meeting. Trump saw the graph and was like, we got a problem here, Marco, right? And like gave him the graph. And then after that, that was really it. You know, there really wasn't a whole lot going on.
That was more for press, man.
It was more for press. And yeah. It was, you know, well, one of the things was there was a big debate. Is it going to be open to press? Is it not going to be open to press? And it ended up not being open to press. And I have a theory for why that happened. We'll get to another story here is they did the video. They, you know, met. It was a pretty tame meeting. Like, I don't think Donald Trump really cared. I think he just knew he's going through the motions to, you know, maybe this will get us off of the gun violence issue because we did this. You know, nothing substantial came out of it. But then afterwards, the White House puts out a press statement and uploads the YouTube video they showed to the official YouTube White House. And in the statement, they say, oh, there may be some connection between games and violence, which, you know, we had shown, well, there isn't. And so they kind of just said it anyway and didn't really listen to anything that it said, because it's still there. It says, oh, games, there may be games that cause violence. And that is the reason that's a big deal. And that video getting uploaded to YouTube is every single thing that the White House uploads on official channels gets archived. So that is American history now, that violence in video games, that video will be there forever. As long as there's a United States, you will be able to find that video. And that means that now there is an official statement in the archive of the White House acknowledging video games may cause violence. And also, here's a hit list of the best violent video games, because somebody on that staff definitely plays violent games and knew, I knew exactly what games to throw on that one.
And the thing that got me curious was they had that video unlisted on their YouTube channel. It wasn't like officially there.
I think what had happened was they put it up there unlisted to make it easier. Like, you know, I've done that times where someone's like, hey, can I have a video for a press? You know, I'm doing a slideshow on PowerPoint. Can you put a YouTube video online for me to go to, click a link to? Yeah, it's unlisted. If you have the link, you got it. Well, someone got the link, it got out, and then next thing you know, it became more public. So it's out there and it's there. But at the end of it, though, I remember after the meeting, you know, it went well. Nothing came out of it. It's not like any regulations were going to be proposed. It's not like the industry made some promise to, you know, do $1 million ad campaigns to brighten its image. It was just kind of like a stale, like, okay, nothing, the best possible result could have happened. Nothing happened.
Yeah.
Later that night, it's reported Donald Trump had gotten a letter from Kim Jong-un. And he comes out that night to say they're going to have the first North Korea U.S. summit, and it's happening during E3. Like it was happening like at June 11th or 12th was when they were going to do it. And it started to make sense why Trump probably wasn't that interested or didn't want to make a big deal out of this, or why he closed that meeting to reporters, is because the bigger story was coming that night. And that was, I've got a handwritten letter from the dictator of North Korea
who wants
to meet with me.
This is going
to
create a buzz.
And then I thought to myself, I was like, you couldn't ask for a greater news, because now it's buried the video game thing, because it was such a nothing story. So now that's buried because everyone's talking about North Korea now. So, you know, that's also kind of, you know, why I think Trump's didn't seem to care from what we understand. And it's just, I think he had a bigger thing on his plate, which was North Korea. And North Korea is a bigger play for him than the hackneyed video games cause violence debate. I mean, they got brutalized by the media for that. That was the most I've seen media take our side on the debate ever. Sometimes you'll see even left-leaning sites go, yeah, games cause violence, we need to regulate. And, you know, it's an issue that right and left will band together on because it's easy points. It's an easy finger to point at and blame.
Yeah, so. Yeah, definitely, man. Well, Reed, I know this was like a good hour or so.
Yeah, man.
It was a great conversation, man. You know, at the same time, I learned a lot of cool stories, man, from you guys, man. And now, what's next for you now? Like, I know you left. Mm-hmm. Are you still want to be involved with the whole gaming stuff? Or
I really loved my time working in the industry and doing things like E3. And I've met so many amazing people, and I had the opportunity to see some really cool stuff and get to build some really cool things through E3 mm-hmm. and other work that I did, that it's hard for me to not want to work in games. But also, I recognize I'm on the East Coast and I live in the Washington and Virginia area, and there just aren't a lot of video game developers or publishers in this area. So for me, you know, I've been given a lot of thought about, you know, what do I want my next big thing to be and all that. And so, you know, there's probably gonna be some podcasting, some media creation, because that's just something I've done all my career.
Yeah.
But it's like, you know, for me in games, it's kind of, I kind of, in a way, after I left ESA, I went to play Rome 2. It's one of my favorite games. And like, I really enjoyed it because it was nice to just be a fan again. It was nice to kind of be like I am if you right now, talking with you about, you know, oh, what does it mean? You know, I used to be on forums. I used to be on the GameSpot forums, System Wars in particular, because I was that guy.
One of those.
I was one of those guys who wanted to get into the games debate. You know, it was like, you know, it was fun to like see people debating, you know, like Apex Legend comes out. So I'm like having some fun tweeting some jokes about it, which normally I would never do because I don't want to make anyone at EA mad because, I've got friends there. But now that I don't have to represent the industry on a daily basis, I can have a little more fun. And, you know, it's just kind of been nice to kind of reclaim that sort of being a gamer and just kind of getting lost in a game again. But then there's always that itch, because once you've, you know, I think that once you've been in games, it's like, you're just kind of like, man, that was cool. Like, you know, when I was, I always make the joke, like, what would I tell 14-year-old Reed? Like, if what would 32-year-old Reed say to 14-year-old Reed? And would he even believe, like, oh yeah, you're going to cover the Capitals when you grow up, and you're going to write about games, and you're going to tweet about games, and you're going to send off a tweet 7 days early that's going to get you on the front page of Kotaku Polygon and stuff like that. Yeah. And it's actually, and no one's going to be mad about it because you handled it well. And it's like, you know, so that stuff's always fun. So I'm just kind of, you know, open for what the next big opportunity is, but also just enjoying that sort of, you know, I get to be the true blue gamer again. And, you know, Division 2 is coming out.
I'm excited.
I can't wait.
I'm excited for that.
I can't wait. You know, Tetris 99 came out. I've got a lot of great opinions. I love Tetris 99.
Same here.
It's just kind of nice to just enjoy games again. And so I think that's something that I've had a lot of people tell me that they kind of have that feeling too. But I know that as we get a little closer to E3 time, you know, I'm really going to miss talking to my 2 million friends on that Twitter account and meeting up with y'all at E3. And part of me is going to be like, all right, let's get back. Let's get back there. Cause that's where I belong. You know,
do you see yourself attending E3 just as a fan of games?
You know, I've been going for 6 years now, and it's such an awesome show, but it falls on the same time as my wife's birthday.
And
was always kind of a struggle because, you know, my wife is great and I love her to death, but that was the week I needed to work. And that was the week where I'm always working. And so I always felt really guilty about, like, all right, we got to do your, you know, we do my birthday on its time, but we have to like schedule yours and change it around. So, you know, I think, you know, if I had a reason to go out to E3, I'd absolutely go. Absolutely. Show's great. I love seeing everyone there. Now, that's the other part that people don't really talk about with E3 is that it's kind of a place where everybody gets together. And it would really suck if we didn't have that. If we didn't have a place where we could all get together and we could all share ideas, and if it was only GDC, if it was only PAX, or if it was only Gamescom, I feel like we would miss it. We would want that E3 anyway, maybe not the way it was, but we'd want to have that ability to all get together, see each other. And, you know, it's a time to celebrate the industry, and nobody's more excited about games than everybody who's at E3, even if they're having a bad time and not enjoying it as much. So, you know, I think the itch to want to be there, I was talking to Melanie, who ran the Twitter account with me. We both kind of like, we're thinking one of our big things we loved working on at E3 was we got to update it, the show store. The show store had kind of been notoriously bad, and she wanted to change that. So she made all these awesome shirts and, you know, helped kind of advise on better products and better things to do. Yeah. And so last year was the first year we really had that. And so now neither of us are going to be there for that this year. And so we're both kind of like worried, like, well, I hope it continues on because that was cool. And, you know, I want to see this show again in a year or 2 years and 3 years. I want to see the Twitter account hit 3 million people. I want to see it be just as fun and do just as crazy stuff we did during the press conferences, because I know that you guys love that stuff and I'd hate for it not to be there. So yeah, I think one day I'd like to, you know, I'll attend as a fan. I'd love to be back there for business. Love to be there as a presenter. That's one of my big goals, is I'd love to be up on stage.
That's awesome.
Announcing, not, you know, I'd like to be not behind a Twitter account telling you guys about what someone announced. I'd like to be the person announcing it one day for someone. And so I think I'm not going to be a stranger. You all will see me.
So be on the lookout for Reed. Reed, if people want to follow you, social media, because you're a social media pro here.
It's just at Reed S. Albers. That's REEDSALBERS. And, you know, I tweet from anything from video games to sports to, you know, joking around and just having a good time. But really, you know, it's I like to kind of share who I am on social media and not be afraid of that. And, you know, there's been times where sharing who I am has, you know, been something that like kind of resulted in people trying to take advantage of that or something, but I don't, you know, comes with the territory, I guess. And it's something that I really enjoy doing. So love to have you follow and love to hear you guys criticize my opinions and, taste in video games, because, I've got a pretty unique taste in games. So.
All right, Reeve. I just want to say thanks, man. It was a great conversation. It was fun.
Yeah, thank you. It was a lot of fun.
You know, professional in the room, you know, little
I know. You've got the Rodecaster Pro, and I just keep staring at it and watching all
you
the
like
levels.
These colors.
And I love the colors. I love the way it works. I'm jealous of you guys. You guys, you You know, I've been listening to Gamertag Radio for a while now, and I know the three of you, Peter and Paris, and you do such an amazing job with it. And so it's an honor to be on the show with you guys, and hope to come back sometime.
Thanks, man. Thanks a lot, man.
You bet.
All right.
Awesome, dude.
Yeah, it was good.
Thanks for listening to Gamertag Radio. Be sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter.